in a legal action filed under a historic law known as the Ku Klux Klan Act. The lawsuit was brought on Tuesday, 16th of February, by the Democratic Congressman Benny Thompson of Mississippi and the eminent civil rights organization, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist David Smith. The piece is titled, Trump and Giuliani Sued by Democratic Congressman Over Capitol Riot. Stay with us for more of David Smith's article. Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani, the former president's personal lawyer, have been accused of conspiring to incite the violent riot at the U.S. Capitol in a legal action filed under a historic law known as the Ku Klux Klan Act. The lawsuit was brought on Tuesday, 16th of February, by the Democratic Congressman Benny Thompson of Mississippi and the eminent civil rights organization, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. It comes 3 days after Donald Trump was acquitted by the U.S. Senate on a charge of inciting the 6th of January insurrection, only for the minority leader Mitch McConnell, who voted to acquit Donald Trump, to point out that presidents are not immune to being held accountable by criminal or civil litigation. The lawsuit alleges that Trump and Giuliani and the extremist groups, the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers, conspired to incite the attack on the Capitol building with the goal of preventing Congress from certifying Joe Biden's win in the presidential election. It argues that they therefore violated a law often referred to as the Ku Klux Klan Act, passed in 1871 in response to Ku Klux Klan violence and intimidation preventing members of Congress in the Reconstruction of Southern United States from carrying out their constitutional duties. The NAACP, founded in 1909, says the statute was designed to protect against conspiracies. Joseph Sellers, who is with the Washington law firm Cohen Milstein and filed the lawsuit on Thompson's behalf, told the Associated Press, "Fortunately, this hasn't been used very much, but what we see here is so unprecedented that it's really reminiscent of what gave rise to the enactment of this legislation right after the Civil War." Thompson, who chairs the House Homeland Security Committee, was among members of Congress who donned gas masks and were rushed to shelter in an office building during the mayhem of Wednesday, 6th of January, in which 5 people died. Members of the extremist group the Proud Boys and the extremist group Oath Keepers have been charged with taking part in the rioting. Thompson said in a statement that Donald Trump's gleeful support of violent white supremacists led to a breach of the Capitol that put my life and that of my colleagues in grave danger. It is by the slimmest of luck that the outcome was not deadlier. While the majority of Republicans in the Senate abdicated their responsibility to hold the president accountable, we must hold him accountable for the insurrection that he so blatantly planned. Failure to do so will only invite this type of authoritarianism for the anti-democratic forces on the far right that are so intent on destroying our country. Filed on Tuesday, 16th of February, in Federal District Court in Washington, the lawsuit charts an expansive effort by Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani to undermine the election result, despite state officials and courts rejecting their false allegations of fraud. The two men portrayed the election as stolen, whilst Donald Trump endorsed rather than discouraged threats of violence from his supporters leading up to the attack on the Capitol, the lawsuit claims. The carefully orchestrated series of events that unfolded at the Save America rally and the storming of the Capitol was no accident or coincidence, it continues. It was the intended and foreseeable culmination of a carefully coordinated campaign to interfere with a legal process required to confirm the tally of votes cast in the Electoral College. Presidents are typically shielded from the courts of law for actions carried out in office, but this one focuses on Donald Trump in his personal rather than official capacity. Seeking unspecified punitive and compensatory damages, it alleges that none of the conduct at issue is related to Trump's responsibilities as president. Joseph Sellers explained, "Inciting a riot or attempting to interfere with the congressional efforts to ratify the results of the election that are commended by the Constitution could not conceivably be within the scope of ordinary responsibilities of the president. In this respect, because of his conduct, Donald Trump is just like any other private citizen." Trump faces a potential slew of lawsuits now he has lost the legal protections of office. Additional actions could be brought by other members of Congress or by police officers injured in the rioting, a prospect acknowledged by the White House on Tuesday. Jen Psaki, the press secretary at the White House, told reporters, "President Biden certainly supports the rights of individuals, members of Congress and otherwise, to take steps through the judicial process, but I don't think we have a further comment on it than that." Jen Psaki added, "I'm not going to speculate on criminal prosecution from the White House podium. The president has committed to having an independent Justice Department that will make their own decision about the path forward." Donald Trump's defense lawyers are expected to argue that his speech was protected by the First Amendment to the Constitution and point out that, in a speech on 6th of January, he told supporters to behave peacefully. Jason Miller, a Trump advisor, said in a statement, "Donald Trump had not organized the rally that preceded the riot and did not incite or conspire to incite any violence at the Capitol on 6th of January."
The Israeli military has once again carried out a number of missile attacks from the occupied Syrian Golan Heights, targeting several army positions near the capital, Damascus. The Syrian media have confirmed the attacks, saying Israeli jets flew over the Golan Heights to hit targets on the edge of Damascus. They also said the country's air defense intercepted and shut down most of the missiles fired toward Damascus. But this is not the first time the regime attacks Syria. Israel has done hundreds of air and missile strikes on government troops and their allies there. Some believe the attacks are aimed at undermining the country's military capabilities.
This has been the focus for the last few years. Israel's focus especially has been towards Syria's air defense systems. I don't think they have been successful, however, because clearly Syrian air defense systems are working well and better than they did at the start of the war. Most of Israel's missiles have been shot down.
The Israeli attacks against Syria have been going on ever since the country was gripped by foreign-backed militancy in March 2011. Syrian government forces have already clawed back much of the territory it lost to terrorist groups in the first couple of years of the Syrian conflict. Syrian troops are now engaged in a few mopping up operations to clear the country from the remnants of Takfiri terror groups. The Syrian government says the Israeli regime and its Western and regional allies are aiding Takfiris that reduced large swathes of Syria to rubble.
Well, the U.S. is continuing their four-decade, tradition of supporting terrorism in the region. They continue to fund the White Helmets, which, as we know, is Al-Qaeda with white hats on. In Idlib province, they continue to try to extend the conflict in the northwest of Syria, where Al Qaeda has taken over the entirety of Idlib province, and they admit that Al Qaeda is the biggest force in that region, and they want to maintain or continue that war for as long as possible by supporting Al Qaeda.
Monday's attack on Syria comes as senior Israeli military officials have previously said that escalating attacks inside the Arab country are aimed at ending Iran's military presence there. This is while Iran says its military presence in Syria is upon a request from the Damascus government, adding that Tehran has not received any message demanding it leave Syria.
Of course, the Syrian government invited Iran to support Syria against the terrorist and Zionist attack. Syria and Iran have been allies for decades. And of course, this is also in Iran's interest because those terrorists will eventually try to attack within Iran. And of course, the whole point of the war is to, why the US caused the war in the first place is for Israel's sake. And that is to try to create a new government in Syria that would not be allied to Iran. They're trying to break up the Syrian-Iranian alliance.
Damascus has sent many letters of protest to the UN to demand a world body end the Israeli aggression. So far, to no avail.
Well, Israel continuously is breaking international law by breaching Syrian sovereignty. And we also know that they have done this for decades in Palestine, and the United Nations hasn't been able to do anything about it. They are now trying to take Israel to the International Criminal Court, and this is something that's been resisted by the US and even Germany. So the problem with the United Nations is that at the end of the day, who controls what happens? It's the country that has the power, that has nuclear weapons. And therefore, the UN is a bit of a joke, because even if they were to condemn Israel for its crimes, which even that they're not able to do, they wouldn't be able to physically do anything to bring Israel to justice.
Many construe the West's silence towards continued Israeli attacks on Syria as tactical support for the aggression. They also attribute the escalation in the attacks to Israel's anger over the victory of Syria and the axis of resistance in the face of the years-long militancy against the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The militancy is widely seen as a foreign-backed plot to bring about regime change in Syria and partition it into weak states in favor of Israel's geostrategic interests. The militancy failed. Now Syria is nearly in full control of its territory and is on track towards stability.
Bahrainis have taken to the streets across the tiny Persian Gulf kingdom to mark the 10th anniversary of a popular uprising against the ruling monarchy. The rallies took place on Saturday night on the eve of the 2011 uprising's anniversary, with the participants chanting slogans against the Al-Khalifa regime and King Hamad bin Isa Al-Khalifa. The protests were held in several towns and villages near the capital Manama. People called for an end to human rights violations and the release of political prisoners. The demonstrators carried pictures of the uprising's leaders and martyrs, as well as placards vowing resistance until victory.
They have waited for almost 100 years of struggle, 100 years of struggle since 1922 until now, and they put forward their demands clearly. They do not want this dictatorship. Now, of course, the situation has become even worse because the Khalifa dictators have become even more anti-people, against the people, with harsh policies. But also, they have gone as far as the Arab and Muslim cause of Palestine, and they have normalized their relationship with the Israelis. The people are simply very angry. They just do not like that. They think this is betrayal, this is treachery.
They also blocked the streets by setting up bonfires despite heavy security and the presence of policemen. The protesters held handwritten posters with messages of solidarity with the families of the martyrs and condemnation of the regime's repression. Additionally, the Coalition Youth of the 14th February Revolution, in a statement, called on all Bahraini groups and masses to close ranks in order to change the ruling political regime in Manama. The Manama regime is pressing ahead with its heavy-handed crackdown and persecution of human rights campaigners and political dissidents, despite condemnations by the international community. Furthermore, the Al-Khalifa regime has begun trying civilians at military tribunals since 2017, a move that has drawn widespread condemnation from human rights bodies and activists and has been described as the imposition of an undeclared martial law across the country. The heavy-handed response saw scores of people dead, thousands arrested, and many tortured in custody over years. The unprecedented suppression drew international outcries. Emboldened by foreign support, the Manama regime dissolved the main opposition party Al-Wefaq in 2016 and put its leaders behind bars. Experts believe the ruling regime in Bahrain is committing such acts with impunity as it enjoys support from Saudi Arabia.
We also know that the Khalifis are receiving orders from the Saudis, from the Emiratis, and this is another problem. They have sold out the sovereignty of the country. We are not a sovereign state. We do not have our own political decisions. We have to follow them. The Emirates and the Saudis say, we want to go and have relations with Israel. Yes, we have to. It is not a matter of discussion and debate. It is a matter of imposition and a matter of following, accepting whatever is being imposed from the outside.
But as Bahrain's most prominent Shia cleric, Sheikh Isa Qasim, noted, the actions of the Al-Khalifa regime and the unwavering support of the Saudi military cannot undermine the determination of the Bahraini people, as a reactionary and cruel rule of the Bahraini regime is incompatible with the will of the people.
On September 11, 2001, two hijacked airplanes were flown into the twin World Trade Center buildings in New York City, resulting in the death of nearly 3,000 people. In the wake of terrorist attacks, the U.S. administration, led by then-President George W. Bush, declared a war on terror, arguing that the need to counter terrorism and people's safety overrides the obligation to respect human rights. With that incentive, the Guantanamo Bay Prison, also known as Gitmo, was established in southern Cuba in January 2002, to hold inmates in a place neither the U.S. nor international law applied. Since then, Guantanamo has been synonymous with human rights abuses perpetrated by the U.S. government in the name of terrorism. Since its establishment, the notorious prison has been under fire for the so-called enhanced interrogation methods used on inmates to force them to confess to crimes that they might not have even committed. Interrogation methods, which international human rights advocates say amounted to torture. Back in 2019, the New York Times published an article containing disturbing methods of torture on a prisoner named Abu Zubaydah. It included methods like waterboarding, walling, and sleep deprivation. At its peak, over 750 inmates have been held in the facility since its establishment. However, based on an Amnesty International report, only seven have been convicted, including five as a result of pretrial agreements under which they pleaded guilty, returned for a possibility of being released from the base. Currently, 40 inmates are incarcerated in Guantanamo without any charges. They are stuck in a legal limbo, languishing there for nearly two decades. That is while the proceedings have been delayed at the pretrial state for several years. That justifies why Guantanamo Bay Prison is a symbol of lingering U.S. injustice. Meanwhile, the conditions in the detention camp are deteriorating. According to a New York Times article following the tropical rains this summer and fall, raw sewage sloshed inside cells and toilets overflowed. Such unsanitary conditions become more alarming when we consider the potential impact on containing the spread of the coronavirus within the prison. Moreover, in late January, the Pentagon halted the plan to offer COVID-19 vaccinations to Guantanamo Bay prisoners. That has raised criticism from health experts and rights groups, as they say prisoners must be high on the priority list to get the vaccine because they are in close contact with the prison staff. With the prisoners stuck in legal limbo, deteriorating infrastructure, and international outcry against torture and injustice, why has the prison been allowed to continue to operate?
Well, it's only because of the power of the United States that it can continue to operate. It's clearly in violation of international law. And people are held without charge in many cases and held indefinitely. And we know that many, many, many hundreds and hundreds of people who were taken to Guantanamo were taken there because they had been turned in by enemies.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has launched a formal review of the offshore U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. The White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters on Friday that Biden intends to close the controversial prison before leaving office, saying that it's a priority of the Biden administration. Closing the Guantanamo Bay prison was initially one of the campaign promises of former U.S. President Barack Obama, who had Joe Biden as his vice president by his side. However, despite being one of the first executive orders of Obama, after assuming office in 2009, he failed to realize this goal, once calling it a stain on U.S. record in upholding rules of law. His only achievement was transferring 197 inmates from the facility to either their home or third-party countries through a review board process. However, former President Donald Trump immediately reversed that policy as soon as he took office in 2017. And kept the controversial prison open during his 4 years in office. Trump's decision to resume rendition to Guantanamo Bay drew outrage from human rights groups who have long campaigned for its closure. That is while experts believe the new administration will encounter the same political and legal obstacles in shutting down the offshore prison as Obama did. Also, it seems the revival of this Obama-era policy is currently hampered by the coronavirus pandemic and its economic fallout.
I don't think there's any great reason to believe that Biden will push ahead. Biden's foreign policy objectives are very much against Iran, against China, against Venezuela and Cuba, maybe not using the same tactics as the Trump administration, but with the same objective in mind.
While an insane amount of $13 million a year for each prisoner is needed to keep the wheels of Guantanamo turning, and the negative impact it's having on America's global image, closing it would be a viable prospect. However, can Joe Biden manage to remove what human rights advocates call a stain on America's global image?
When Lujuan Al-Hatoul, a prominent women's rights activist, sat in her car and drove into Saudi Arabia in 2014, using her valid UAE driving license, she was arrested and sent to jail, spending 73 days in a women's detention facility. This sparked her campaign to launch an attack against the archaic male-dominated guardianship system run by the Saudi regime. Yet it was in March 2018 when she was essentially forced out of the UAE and flown back to Riyadh and placed under house arrest before being moved to prison that saw her and other women's rights activists clamped down on by the Bin Salman regime. It hence raises the question that if the despotic Saudi crown prince Bin Salman is so keen on reforms, why then is he so quick to silence the women of his country, especially in the face of a simple and basic human rights demand, such as being able to drive a car?
In a sense, in his own mind, he's serious, but in terms of world image, he's not serious. His actions are very crude to imprison someone that was not a physical threat or of any kind. It seems to me that Lu Jian is really seen as a an exponent of Western human rights ideas.
Many from around the world have condemned the arrest of Al-Hatoul, with UN Special Rapporteur Agnes Callamard stating that the cruelty of Saudi Arabia rulers that kept her away from her family, her home, that violated her most basic right to physical and mental integrity, should not be forgotten, suggesting that even though she'd been released, the act by the Saudi regime should still be remembered. The global awareness group Human Rights Watch also celebrated the fact that Al-Hatoul had been released, with its director Ken Roth stating that he was happy that she'd been released, yet he reminded all that they must not forget the so-called reforms by Ben Salman and nothing more than a distraction of the real events happening in the kingdom. With Al-Hatoul now back home, what now remains to be seen is whether she will actually remain free, or the Saudi regime, led by Ben Salman, continue to suppress Al-Hatoul and many more like her. They say that money can buy anything, and this is truer than ever when it comes to the Saudi regime. One only has to look at the way Ben Salman bought the silence of ex-US President Donald Trump following the murder of Jamal Khashoggi in Turkey. Therefore, are the messages of condemnation against the Saudi human rights simply a fake fanfare ignored by Riyadh at their leisure? With many activists in Saudi Arabia still languishing behind bars, the case of Al-Hatoul is just one of many, and as the Saudi regime continue to pump billions into the military arms complex of Western nations, are the condemnations echoed by the West simply double standards?
Well, of course it does, but Saudi Arabia has been the linchpin, really, of American Middle East policy, foreign policy. And in a sense, that ties in with world policy. If Saudi Arabia goes, there will be dominoes, a domino effect of other regimes, and it will leave Israel much more isolated.
One such example is the British government, who have recently agreed to authorise the sale of £1.9 billion worth of military equipment to the Saudi regime, whilst at the same time preaching to the world that human rights actually matter. Where then did the rights of the people of Yemen go in this statement? Yet for the British, the sale of arms and turning a blind eye to war crimes has come from necessity rather than security. As Brexit takes its toll on the British economy, the sale of arms is nothing more than an act of state begging, something that the Saudi regime are happy to toss a few coins into the outstretched British hand to buy their silence with. As Bin Salman attempts to use his so-called reforms to paint a false impression to the world that he is the saviour of change, the truth of the matter is that the image, the brand, and the goodwill shown by Bin Salman and his team is nothing more than a charade designed to fool the theatre audience into the Saudi divine comedy.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
The limelight.
Protests in Haiti have led to hundreds of deaths, yet have drawn little attention in the West, thanks in large part to its strongman leaders' continued loyalty to the United States of America. The U.S. has been interfering in Haitian politics throughout the nation's 200-year existence. For decades, it refused to recognize the new republic, fearing that legitimizing the slave uprising would inspire its own enslaved black population to rebel, says Alan McLeod, writer in an article published under the heading "Stop Interfering in Our Lives." Haitian protesters condemn U.S. support for dictator. Stay tuned for the details, please. After 5 years of highly contentious rule, Haitian President Jovenel Moïse was scheduled to finally step down last week. However, his announcement that he would stay in office for at least one more year brought fresh impetus to nationwide protests that have continued almost unbroken since 2018. The protests have led to hundreds of deaths yet have drawn little attention in the West, largely because Moïse continues to be a loyal U.S. ally. Thousands of people are out on the streets of Port-au-Prince daily, building barricades, burning tires, and demanding the president's resignation. Many have been met with rubber bullets and even live ammunition from Moïse's forces. Increasingly, however, public anger and frustration are turning towards the United States, and in particular, U.S. Ambassador Michel Jean Sisson. Down with Sisson has become a rallying cry of the movement after the U.S. State Department threw its weight behind Moïse, backing his plan to stay in power until next year. In accordance with the Organization of American States' position on the need to proceed with the democratic transfer of executive power, a new elected president should succeed President Moïse when his term ends on February 7, 2022, said the State Department spokesperson Ned Price. In a widely shared video on social media, one Haitian protester sent a message directly to the ambassador. "Madam Sisson, Haiti is not for George Bush. It's not for the Clintons. It is for Jean-Jacques Dessalines," he says, referencing the country's revolutionary hero. "Stop interfering in our lives and in our nation. Down with Jovenel. Take him away and do whatever you want with him," he adds. Experts appeared unsurprised that the United States of America was drawing the protesters' ire. The embassy is making clumsy attempts to fending off a crisis of legitimacy that has been mounting for years now. Jeff Sprague, author of Paramilitarism and the Assault on Democracy in Haiti, told Mint Press News recently. The U.S. government holds the biggest share of responsibility, with the OAS and the UN coming in a close second. The U.S. has been interfering in Haitian politics throughout the nation's 200-year existence. For decades, it refused to recognize the new republic, fearing that legitimizing the slave uprising led by Toussaint Louverture and Jean-Jacques Dessalines would inspire its own enslaved black population to rebel. It also supported the forced payment of enormous reparations to France, something which Haiti was not able to pay off until 1947. Throughout much of the 20th century, the United States directly occupied Haiti, doing so for 19 continuous years between 1915 and 1934. At other times, it kept vicious and brutal dictatorships in place on the island, most notably the regimes of François Papadoc and Jean-Claude Babidoc Duvalier. Babidoc was overthrown by a popular rebellion in 1986, paving the way for the country's first popularly supported leader, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, elected in 1990 despite considerable American pressure against it. Aristide was quickly overthrown by American help, and after he was re-elected again, the U.S. engineered another coup in 2004, exiling him to South Africa. Since his banishment, Washington has partnered with successive rulers to plunder the Caribbean nation. This process accelerated after the devastating 2010 earthquake that left Haiti in such a poor state that it was powerless to stop a foreign takeover of the island engineered by the US and the UN. The political scene in Haiti has been manipulated through a long history of Western intervention, Sprague said. Today we see the latest example with the US-backed government of Jovenel Moise attempting to illegally do away with the country's anti-Duvalierist constitution. After dismissing parliament last year, Moise has been ruling by decree, while he has lost support from a number of important sectors of society, including the influential Catholic Church. If history is any judge, continued backing from Washington could remain crucial in extending his rule for at least one more year. One reason why the protest movement is turning its sights directly towards President Biden and the U.S. Embassy.
Around the world with reporters.
Alleged favoritism at the heart of the British government, committed by Dominic Cummings, the former top aide to Prime Minister Boris Johnson. UK High Court documents suggest he played an instrumental role in awarding a lucrative contract to a polling firm run by his friends in March last year. There was no formal contract, prior advertisement, or competitive tender process. After only a shake of hands, Public First, a company run by two former colleagues of Cummings and Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove, was paid £540,000 out of the public purse in March last year to research Britain's understanding of the coronavirus and the government's messaging around the pandemic. What started as an informal contract was only formalized retrospectively in June 5 and publicized a week later.
Yet another black mark against the government in its whole handling of the COVID-19 crisis and other situations in which there seem to have been shortcuts made, handing out very large contracts, very valuable contracts indeed, to friends and even family of Conservative ministers or donors to the Conservative Party.
The story was first revealed by The Guardian and Open Democracy in July last year, but was brushed aside as nonsense. In a written statement to the UK High Court, which he did not attend, Cummings admitted he was friends with the company's directors, but denied he recommended them for that reason. He claimed there had been no time to follow usual procurement rules and the work was crucial to the government's early pandemic response. But the Good Law Project, the not-for-profit campaign group that has brought the judicial review of the contract, disagrees saying money paid to associates on a handshake and formalized later is unlawful.
Quite frankly, it's not acceptable that there has to be a robust system in place which ensures that all contracts are awarded to companies on the basis of their performance and not on the basis of who they know.
The judge in the case is yet to fix a date for a ruling, but the Good Law Project say they're determined that the truth should see the light of day. Although the government is desperate to keep this and similar cases under wraps for their considerable public importance. Saeed Pourriza, London.
EU finance ministers have just concluded 2 days of talks relating to the 27-country bloc's dire economic situation resulting from the COVID-19 pandemic.
It has been a particular challenge for young women and men, but also those who are employed in contact-intensive parts of our economies.
One such person is Simon Ledoux, who worked in the hospitality industry in Brussels. He feels abandoned by the state since losing his job.
I feel very depressed. I'm looking for a job, but I didn't find. And my friends, like me, didn't find job.
The social crisis in the EU continues to deepen. Richer member states are being urged to support poorer ones. Within the EU, social rights campaigners say solidarity is now needed like never before in the bloc's history, because of huge disparities among member states in terms of their ability to cope and recover. The European Commission warns a record number of businesses will go under when governments start easing financial aid programmes. The Commission claims firms that were not viable prior to the crisis will be impacted most. Only 6 EU nations have so far submitted draft plans to draw down money from a €750 billion coronavirus recovery fund.
I call on the remaining countries to ratify the own resources decision quickly so that the Commission can start its borrowing program under the Next Generation EU.
Illegal US sanctions against Iran preventing EU businesses from trading with the Islamic Republic show how the dollar is too dominant over the euro. Eurozone finance ministers have been encouraged to strengthen the currency's position on the international stage.
Recent episodes where the dollar was used as a policy tool reminded us that this is not good from a European perspective.
Economists warn the biggest threat to the Eurozone economy right now is the EU's dysfunctional COVID-19 vaccination strategy. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After months of discussion and some rough debates, members of the French Parliament have voted a new law, officially called the Law on Principles of the Republic. French authorities say they want to strengthen the respect of equality, fraternity and liberty. But the opposition denounces, as it was called first, the Law on Separatism. They sound the alarm on the stigmatization of the Muslim community.
Aujourd'hui, de plus en plus,
more and more children do not go to the same schools because of the social origin of their parents. That's school separatism. Without saying it, this law concerns only our fellow Muslim citizens and creates a debate on identity rather than on social problems. During weeks, this debate has been a festival of discrimination towards Muslims.
French Interior Minister Darmanin already said that mosques will be closely monitored. Law experts say that this text can be interpreted in different ways, which could lead to arbitrary decisions like the closure of watchdog associations defending the rights of Muslims. Opposition members in the parliament blame the government for not being concerned about the real social problems of the population.
Yes, there is a separatism in this country, a separatism in school and in the French territory. This bill does not speak about it. Our children, depending on which school they go to, do not have the same chances. The public school is weakened.
The opposition group in the French parliament also criticizes the actual French government for seducing far-right voters, as the new French president will be elected in only a year. What is more important, security issues or social welfare?
On a vécu 2 ans.
We had 2 years of social agitation with a yellow vest movement and a movement against the retirement law. The poverty and social inequality are exploding in France. But no, they debate on the headscarf.
The reaction of the Muslim community is taking form, but slowly and in a dispersed order. Hundreds demonstrated in Paris, and hundreds of religious leaders and human rights associations asked members of parliament in a public letter not to vote this law on separatism. The law has been adopted by a majority in the French parliament, but Muslims and human rights defenders already promised to continue the protest. Chris Den Hont, Paris.
Turkish president vowed that the cross-border military operations that Turkish military is conducting against PKK will continue, as he confirmed Ankara's willingness to expand areas of operations from which threats against Turkey are coming, assuring that the death of 13 Turkish citizens who lost their lives in the Gara attack will strengthen the government's determination to eliminate terrorist groups.
Northern Iraq's Gara province has now been made secure as a result of a 4-day military operation. We will stay in the areas that we have made safe in a bid to avoid similar attacks. Gara was a troubled region. It is taken now and the problem is gone.
Turkish Defense Minister, along with Interior Minister, met with opposition figures Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu and Meral Akşener separately and explained in details the military operation that was conducted in the region. The two ministers also briefed the parliament on the circumstances of the operation and the martyrdom of 13 Turkish citizens on the hands of PKK. Analysts say the meetings and parliament session were in preparation to draft a resolution to grant the Turkish army the permission to hold wide-range cross-border operation in Sinjar and other areas in northern Iraq.
The war between Turkey and the PKK has been going on for decades. However, I think this time a decision is being made to eliminate the group's terrorists wherever they are. The operation will include Sinjar and Kandil areas. I think all political parties will agree on launching a wider cross-border operation despite knowing that such a decision will be met with opposition from European countries and of course Turkey's NATO ally, the United States.
Turkey accused the U.S. of siding with terrorists. Turkish president said the U.S. statement concerning the death of 13 Turkish citizens is considered, quote, a joke. Other Turkish politicians and political parties also condemned it, saying the U.S. exposed its cooperation with PKK in such a statement. It seems that, unlike Turkish expectations, the new U.S. administration, like its predecessors, will continue to support the Kurdish groups. Many expect the two NATO allies go into another round of tensions. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
February 2011. Emboldened by what was then hailed as the Arab Spring, people took to the streets in Bahrain. The crackdown that followed was brutal. Hospitals overflowed with the dead and injured, and the prisons filled up. On the 10th anniversary of the pro-democracy movement, the European Centre for Democracy and Human Rights held a conference. According to the speakers, the situation in Bahrain is worse now than before 2011, with hundreds of journalists, human rights defenders, and opposition figures still behind bars. The US and the UK have military bases in Bahrain. Human rights organizations say both are complicit in the monarchy's rights abuses by refusing to exert the influence they obviously have over the monarchy.
Bahrain is a political ally of the West. It's not some other, you know, this country that there is no kind of form of leverage or control over. In fact, the strength of US and British leverage on the regimes is so strong that it actually, I would say, coerce some of these regimes into entering the normalization deal with Israel that was perceived by, you know, across the board in Bahrain, you know, pro and anti-government people as the final act of betrayal.
One aspect of Bahrain's repressive tactics has received international attention: torture and sexual abuse used in prisons. And the UK's complicity is irrefutable. It trained Bahrain's police force, which carries out the torture, and the Special Investigations Unit, which continues to fail the victims. Some are on death row after giving false confessions under duress, and others live on with the horror playing before their eyes every day. We spoke to one of the victims.
It wasn't a prison, it was a morgue. You had no right to say you were innocent. If you did, they would start the torture, psychological torture. They would give us hallucination drugs. None of the guards were Bahraini. And they weren't normal. They were sick. They would make fun of us for missing our kids and family. Those who had kids were tortured the most. They weren't allowed to have visitors if they so much as drank water without permission. I think of those women. God help them.
Britain's top military brass were in Bahrain 5 days before the 2011 crackdown, in which 1,000 Saudi troops trained and equipped by the UK backed Bahrain's security forces. And since then, Britain has given Bahrain £6.5 million worth of technical assistance. Pressure is growing on Westminster to end the collusion, but Downing Street's damning record proves strategic interests trump human rights concerns every time. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Palestinian prisoners incarcerated in the Israeli military jail of Aufer started a partial strike by refusing to take their meals in protest against the escalated successive repression and assaults of the Israeli prison service. According to the Palestinian Prisoners Club Association, for almost 2 weeks, prisoners in Aufer jail have been subjected to harassment and repression, including surprise night raids and intensive unannounced cell search, strip searches, and being sprayed with poisonous gases, in addition to deliberate medical negligence.
A big number of administrative detainees are held in Aufer. What's going on there amounts to a crime being planned by the prison's officials. They want to bring the prisoners of Aufer to their knees. They have escalated their aggressive measures, such as carrying out several surprise searches of cells day and night.
Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are held in Aufer jail, including minors. Prisoners' advocacy groups say the inmates have sent a clear message to the prison administration that if these invasions and assaults that are against international laws and the Geneva Convention do not come to an end, then the prisoners will escalate their protest measures within the coming days.
Prisoners' lives are in danger because they don't intend to remain silent against this brutality. Prisoners now are planning other measures to protest their conditions, including refusal to talk with prison administrators and starting an open-ended hunger strike.
Reports say over 4,500 Palestinians are currently languishing in a number of Israeli jails, including hundreds being held without charge or trial under the illegal imprisonment known as administrative detention. Palestinian prisoners have always endured the grievous oppression in Israeli jails. However, people in the occupied territories are worried today about their loved ones. They are concerned not only about recent brutal measures taken in the Israeli jail of Aufer, but also about the reports that more inmates there and in other jails have been tested positive for the coronavirus. Muna Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
This country has achieved an extraordinary feat, administering a total of 15 million jabs into the arms of some of the most vulnerable people in the country.
One of few successes in the UK government's handling of a pandemic that's left the country of about 67 million with a higher death toll and worse economic damage than many others. But with the situation improving, should the government open the country up for business? Members of the Prime Minister's own party are calling on him to commit to a timetable for scrapping the lockdown in the coming months. But the Prime Minister says he will only follow the evidence.
We've got to be very prudent. And what we want to see is progress that is cautious but irreversible.
Infections are falling but remain high. And former Prime Minister Tony Blair thinks the way to stop them soaring when the restrictions are eased is to issue vaccine passports, certificates that prove you have received the jab.
I think it's a step too far to have your movement controlled locally by some kind of passport or a piece of paper. I think that's way too far.
Some people cannot be vaccinated because of health reasons. It's just not safe for them. So to discriminate against those people and say, well, you're just not able to go to a coffee shop, go to a different country, that doesn't seem particularly just and fair.
On Monday, Health Secretary Matt Hancock insisted vaccine passports were not for domestic use.
but there are countries that are actively floating this idea and proposing it. And in that case, it will be important for people from the UK to be able to show whether or not they've been vaccinated in order to travel.
That seemed to resonate well with the people we spoke to.
I think it's a really good idea, you know. I think that so as we can travel is the main thing, really, what I'm sort of interested in, getting abroad for a bit of sun.
I think it's a good idea. I think if it means we can get back to doing summer holidays and travelling abroad, seeing family abroad, then I don't see why not.
Monday saw the launching of the UK's hotel quarantine regime, a new 10-day isolation for British residents returning from 33 COVID variant hotspots. Critics say the move is too little too late.
The UK is under an indefinite lockdown at the moment to curb the spread of the virus. Next week, the Prime Minister will unveil his so-called roadmap for the months ahead. But with his track record riddled with failures in handling the pandemic since it began, will Boris Johnson get it right this time? Saeed Pourizza, London.
Iran has informed the International Atomic Energy Agency it plans to stop taking voluntary measures that give the agency broader access under the so-called Additional Protocol. Iran has been implementing the Additional Protocol voluntarily as part of its commitments under the nuclear deal with world powers known as the JCPOA.
I have delivered a letter from the government of the Islamic Republic of Iran to the Director General of the IAEA specifying that as of 23rd February 2021, Iran will stop all voluntary measures beyond its safeguard commitments as envisaged in the JCPOA.
Kazem Gharibabadi said as of February 23rd, cooperation between Iran and the IAEA would be based solely on the country's safeguards agreement with the agency. If U.S. sanctions are effectively lifted, he added, Iran would resume implementation of all voluntary measures. The decision is in line with a law approved by the Iranian parliament almost 2 months ago, obliging the government to reduce IAEA access and step up nuclear enrichment if U.S. sanctions are not lifted, specifically those imposed against Iranian oil exports and the country's banking system. The previous U.S. administration under President Donald Trump reimposed the sanctions as part of a maximum pressure policy after withdrawing from the nuclear deal in 2018. Meanwhile, Iran has also informed the IAEA of its serious concerns over the protection of confidential information. In an official letter, Iran has asked the agency to revise its policies in order to avoid the far too common instances of IAEA reports being leaked to the media via unauthorized access, potentially threatening the country's national security. Since it was implemented in 2016, the nuclear deal has given the IAEA unprecedented access to Iranian nuclear sites. But that level of cooperation would inevitably come to an end if efforts to revive the JCPOA fail. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
Ex-President Donald Trump has been acquitted in his second impeachment trial, finally closing the curtain on the nation's bitterly disputed election last November. Trump was accused of incitement to insurrection after a violent protest stormed Capitol Hill as Congress was certifying the Electoral College's selection of Joe Biden. Polls still show that around 40% of voters think that Biden's victory was illegitimate. Public opinion was almost evenly split regarding Trump's responsibility in the Capitol Hill protests and along party lines. The Senate vote's outcome was never in doubt, as a two-thirds supermajority was needed for conviction. The trial was surprisingly rushed to completion.
Trump's big sin, from the point of view of the American ruling class, is that he brought the pitchforks to the castle. And that's what the ruling class is, and the entire apparatus of status quo politics in the United States is punishing Donald Trump for, and wants to make sure never happens again.
Democrats now have to contend with an exonerated Trump who can run for the presidency in 2024. Conservatives may be permanently divided into two factions, and polls show that a third party started by Trump would be even more popular than the Republican Party. The final fate of the controversial Trump seemed to overshadow what sparked the violent protest in the first place, yet the question remains, how can massive and violent disputes over electoral integrity be prevented?
A, have an electoral system that people have confidence in and can have confidence in, which we don't have. But even more, hey,